From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, a plea to parents to throw away those flashcards. I speak with Dr. David Elkind, an expert in child development, who thinks the trend to educate preschoolers is miseducation. Also today, I talk with Broadway sound designer Martin Levan. The days when Ethel Merman belted it out to the balcony are over. For Andrew Lloyd Webber's latest musical, Phantom of the Opera, Levan's using state-of-the-art amplification. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews Nine Below Zero, the new album from pianist Wayne Horvitz, cornetist Butch Morris, and drummer Bobby Previtt. And TV critic David Bianculli previews Television, the 8-hour history of the medium airing on many public television stations. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. Dr. David Elkind is critical of a recent phenomenon in child rearing, the desire to raise super kids, kids who can swim, read, work computers, play the violin, and recognize a Picasso before they've even entered kindergarten. To Dr. Elkind, this preschool pressure is miseducation. Elkind is a professor of child study at Tufts University, where he is the senior resident scholar. He's also the president of the National Association for the Education of Young Children. His latest book is titled Miseducation, Children at Risk. I spoke to him from station WBUR in Boston. He told me what he means by miseducation.
Well, I guess I ought to define miseducation first. What I mean is teaching children the wrong things and putting them at risk for no purpose. A good example is swimming for infants of 3 months. We know that infants are particularly subject to middle ear infection and potentially permanent hearing loss. They're subject to autoasphyxiation from swallowing water, and they're also subject to diarrhea if those infants are not toilet trained and are not properly packaged. So there are a lot of risks. There's no proven benefit. There's no evidence that children retain the skills they learn. They have to relearn at a later age. So here's a clear evidence of children being engaged in an activity which puts them at risk, has no proven benefit, and that's what I mean really by miseducation. The same was with showing infants flashcards at 3 months.
Well, what's the risk there? They're not going to get diarrhea from it.
Pardon me? You're not going to get diarrhea from it. That's true. Maybe metal that. But there's no proven value to it, and it does perhaps for some parents who get too involved in it, it can put the relationship between the infant and the child and the mother or father at risk because they've got too caught up in right answers, wrong answers. It's the wrong attitude to have towards an infant. We shouldn't be expecting an infant to be getting something right or wrong. And so it can, and that's a period when it's very important for children to learn a sense of trust in their parents, the sense that these parents are going to be there for them and take care of them regardless. And so it puts, you know, the relationship at risk. Now, some parents may, you know, may not get that kind of involved, but some parents may. So why do it? Why risk that kind of engagement when it has no proven value?
You make the point that parents used to be concerned about having normal kids, and now they want super kids, and they want to make normal kids into exceptional kids. What do you think is responsible for that change?
Well, I think there's a new parent psychology today. I think we were in the past. There's always been a sort of switch from nature to nurture, from the environment to the heredity and so on. And I think we had a kind of nature attitude, maturation, readiness. We thought that, you know, we just let children grow and allow them to grow. And then that changed really in the 60s, and we became much more concerned with nurture. Almost anything you could do, you know, you could change children in any way and make them almost anything. You know, in the 60s, we heard that you could teach any child anything at any time. The children were little sponges, and they just sopped up information. They had half of their abilities at age 4, so they had to get all this stuff. So there was a whole new psychology, and I think what's happened is that parents today believe that they have a great deal more responsibility for how their children turn out, and that makes them much more anxious and much more guilty. Am I doing the right thing? I mean, parents have always felt that, but when they feel that they have so much input, and that anxiety and guilt, I think, makes them particularly vulnerable now to the entrepreneurs who are selling all these programs. Unless you use my program, your child isn't going to become or realize his potential isn't going to become a little Leonardo or something. And so I think that there's the change parental psychology, parents having fewer children, the parents having them longer at older ages, having a greater sense of somehow their responsibility of you know, that unless they do the right thing, their children aren't going to turn out right and it's going to be their fault. I think that parents in the past had a greater sense of the maturational thing, and that their input wasn't going to make that much difference. It was important. And so I think that's what's different, and I think it's the anxiety and the guilt that many parents feel today which makes them so vulnerable to the swimming classes and the flashcards and the gymberies and all of those other things, which may, they're on a continuum from least, gymberie, it may do very little harm to children, and to some things like swimming, which can, have very lethal consequences. So,
when you say anxiety and guilt that parents are feeling, you mean their anxiety and guilt about working and not being home with the children?
No, that too, but I think partly that, and partly about their sense of responsibility for the child, that they feel that how that child turns out is going to be largely their responsibility. Often they've carved their own careers, they've been successful, they feel that they've had it worked out their own marriages, they feel that they've been a superwoman or superman, and now they should have a super child. And so they feel there's a greater sense of being in charge of their own lives and being in charge of their children. And suddenly, as one mother told me recently, who's an executive, that suddenly here was this child that she really felt she could handle, and all of a sudden it just didn't work the way she thought it was going to work. And he keeps calling her Dada instead of Mama, and doing things that the infant isn't just as manageable as other things might have been in her life. And so it's that sort of thing at the one hand, feeling that you have more charge and you have more control, and then discovering that you don't, and also this great sense of your ability to input into that. And then, as you say, then there's the added guilt and that feeling that way, and then feeling that you have to work and not put in all of the time and energy that you need means that often parents will go overboard to compensate for that and rationalize often that a child needs this high-pressure program to alleviate their own guilt rather than because they really are convinced that it's in the best interest of the child. So there are a lot of different dynamics going on, but the end result is that we miseducate children, we engage them in activities which put them at risk, have no proven value.
My guest is Dr. David Elkin. He is a professor at Tufts University and the author of several books on child development. His new book is called Miseducation: Preschoolers at Risk. You know, you talk about the different kinds of motivations that different types of parents have for miseducating their children. And I'd like to go through with you some of the categories that you've suggested that different parents fall into. I think this is actually very instructive. You've labeled one group of parents gourmet parents. Would you describe what the motivation there is?
Yeah. Gourmet parents are often parents who have been successful in their own lives, and they want to share that success with their children, which is perfectly appropriate, except they often do it at too early an age, so that children are three, maybe taken to Europe, go to fancy restaurants, taken to ski slopes and so on. And that's fine to share that kind of experience and, wealth with children, but once they're old enough to fully appreciate and take credit and enjoy it. But at an early age, it can just have the opposite effect. It can make children a little bit arrogant, a little bit superior to other children and to the teachers and so on. And so it may have negative consequences. It's not that it's bad in and of itself. It's bad because it's introduced to children too early before they really can appreciate and benefit from it.
Then you introduce a category which you call gold medal parents.
Yeah, gold medal parents are those who believe that the royal road to success in life is achievement in sports, and they go to great lengths of both expense and time and money to train their child in particular sports such as skating and ice skating, tennis, swimming. And there, again, there's nothing wrong with that, except that parents are beginning to start with children at younger and younger ages, even before the age of five, so that children are three and so on. I don't think one can really assess whether a child at that age has talent. Children at that age are still vulnerable. The bones aren't fully calcified. The muscles haven't attained full volume. Put the child at risk for physical ailments. There's a whole specialty of pediatrics, not pediatric sports medicine, for children who have injuries through sports. And so, and particularly with the preschool level, there are real dangers. There's dangers of putting a child at that age in competition. Again, some children may not be harmed and may survive it very well, and some families may handle it very well. Others don't, and again, because there's no proven benefit that starting a child that early has any long-lasting value as opposed to starting the child later when he or she is more mature physically and emotionally and sociologically, then why do it? And it's just this sort of new psychology that somehow earlier is better, and that if you start a child earlier, the child will end faster and better. And again, that's simply not true.
Well, you raise the point, well, why do it? And you say that a lot of the parents who fit into this category hold middle management jobs, and they want the sense of vicarious excitement through their children.
That's true. I think that some of these parents that I see anyway, the are sort of a dead end in their career. They really don't see themselves going anywhere, and their jobs are dull. And then the child's competition provides excitement, challenge in their own lives, and so they live in a way vicariously through the children.
There's a group that I found especially interesting here. You describe this group as encounter group parents. Would you describe
that? Encounter group parents are sort of a carryover from the 60s. They're parents who are very much into psychotherapy and to the various kinds of programs and into the letting things, expressing things, getting things out in the open, talking, relating, connecting, all of those. And that can be a very healthy orientation. Again, there's nothing wrong with any of these styles, except it's inappropriate for children at an early age. And because some of these parents want to, you know, walk around nude for little children, if the whole society does that, it may be okay, but we don't do that in our society, and it can be embarrassing for that child. And there are other things. So, you know, again, it's wanting children to, the motivation in itself is nothing wrong with wanting children to be open psychologically and know what their feelings are, to talk and express themselves. But three-year-olds are not in a position to really know what their feelings are, to know how to deal with nudity, or some parents even, you know, have the children watch them engage in sexual activity. Little ones really can't deal with that very well, and so it would be better, if you really believe in those things, to postpone it until the time when children are sufficiently old enough so they can talk about it anyway and deal with the feelings in a reasonable way. But children really can't, little ones really can't talk about their feelings, and so they may be frightened or they may be excited without any way of dealing with that.
Yeah, this is a kind of super kid that I hadn't thought of myself in these terms, but you say that some parents want their kids to be psychological super kids and to be so open and honest and, you know, understanding of emotions. You say that these are the parents, too, who think that it's never too young to tell their children about the dangers of nuclear war. Now, I think this is the type of thing that really parents don't know what to do about. I mean, do you think that there is a time when you do not want to tell your children about it, when it's not going to help them to be more understanding about the world and caring about each other?
That's right.
Just forget telling them about it.
It may be just frightening. For example, people want to teach young children about AIDS. Well, what are young children going to do about AIDS? Are they going to stop having sex? I mean, you know, all you do, they know that there's something frightening out there. They can't do anything about it. And so I learned long ago as a therapist that you try never to take anything away from a patient without giving them something in return. When you tell a young child about a threatening thing like AIDS or something, the child may be frightened by that or nuclear war, but what is the child going to do? There's nothing the child can do to take any action. If you're an adult, you can, you know, you can take precautions. If you're an adult, you can march against nuclear war, you can write letters, you can take some action. But if you're a little child, what can you do? All you can do is be frightened. And so when we expose children to those things, we should make very sure that there's something that children can do about it, that we don't just tell them there's something frightening out there, but we give them some way of handling the anxieties that we create. And I think that hasn't happened. We want to share our anxieties with the child, but we don't share you know, the capacity to deal something with those anxieties. So I think the problem with that is that many parents feel this kind of need to share their anxiety with a child. The child should be aware, but they don't follow through in providing that child with some, you know, way, rational way, a meaningful way to deal with the anxiety. And if they can't do that, then the child shouldn't be exposed to it in the first place.
Another example that falls into the category that you describe is encounter group parents. You say that a lot of parents, in wanting their children to really understand the ways of the world, will have their four-year-old present at the mother's birth of a new child. Do you think it's bad for a young child to witness childbirth? I think more and more parents are doing that as a way to make the new baby more real, you know, for the sibling.
Well, here again is a good example of miseducation. There's absolutely no evidence, research evidence. There's no tradition, social or cultural, to back that up. It almost ends up being a fad. We know that it's a frightening experience for a four-year-old. One mother, as I try to say in the book, said, you know, it's going to bring us closer together in the family. There's absolutely no evidence for that a child witnessing that, bringing it closer together than as a family. It's a kind of a faddish thing, which for a four-year-old, it's the mother's in pain, there's blood, the child doesn't understand that, all of what's going on. It can be a very frightening experience. Later on, the child can understand the whole process of birth and so on, but not at that age. So you end up, again, frightening the child without the child really being, children don't really understand the whole biological process. They don't understand life and death, basically, because they don't understand biology. And that doesn't really happen until 9 or 10. So the whole functioning can just be a very, very frightening experience without much cognitive understanding of what's going on, and without any research or any data or any social or cultural or religious tradition to back it up. So I have to believe it's a fad, and yet, as you say, many, many parents are doing it under this sort of pressure that, you know, that there's some kind of magic to this experience, which is somehow going to benefit the child. And what's really sort of, you know, amazing to me, these are intelligent, well-meaning parents who get caught up in such fads. And although they would check very carefully before they gave their child a vitamin, they looked at they look at the ingredients of all the foods, the food additives and so on, and yet they do these things. It reminds me of people who have worked so hard to put up their life savings. They work, you know, and all of a sudden they'll give the whole savings to some person they've just met who's going to invest it for them. It's this kind of disparity between that is so striking that in some ways we are very, very cautious, in other ways we just throw caution to the winds.
I want to talk with you more about different manifestations of the super kid phenomenon, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is Dr. David Elkind. He's a professor at Tufts University and the author of several books on child development. His new book is titled Miseducation: Preschoolers at Risk. We'll talk more after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest, Dr. David Elkind, is the president of the National Association for the Education of Young Children. You know, I'm thinking for parents who don't really want to worry about their children reading before kindergarten or learning, you know, math or foreign languages, there's still so much pressure from the society. For instance, if everybody else on your block is teaching their kids this stuff early, then you do run the risk of your children feeling kind of behind and out of it when they go to school. What would you suggest to parents who feel that at this point, since so many parents are sending their children to these early programs, that you have to do it just to keep up?
Well, I know that many parents feel that way, And all I can do is reassure them that if they don't, the child will not be left out. There have always been children who are different and who don't do things that everybody else in the neighborhood does. Certain children who don't belong to the same religion as other children don't do it. And parents, if they feel strongly about that, they say, well, this is not what my child does. And so I think you have to feel exactly the same way about these high-pressure things. I've seen many children, for example, whose parents did not allow them to watch television. They, their friends watch television and so on. And it was hard, but I see them now at the college level, and they're doing very well. They're good readers. They're interested. They're not deficient in friends or anything else. It just means, I think it's just very hard, are harder today to be a parent in some ways than it has been in the past because there are all these pressures. And what we have to recognize is that they may do children more harm than good, and that if you really believe strongly in not having this kind of over-academic pressure at an early age, that enroll your child in a good child-centered nursery school or program. And I think that the other thing is to find parents who share the same values and the same orientation as you do, so that you have a support group of parents who feel the same way. And I think that it's like so many other things. If you really feel strongly about it, I think one has to, bite the bullet and really resist some of the social pressures. Easy for me to say. I know that.
Your kids are grown. I think a lot of parents will want to know, what are the effects of these early education programs? Will they help someone? Will they help a child learn when they get to school? Will the advancement really pay off? What is the evidence on that? Are there any studies about the actual academic values of this early education?
Well, we're just beginning to get some. Some of the studies which suggest that the early academic programs, for example, the ones that have been followed up, but there's one study, a recent study, which is one of the best ones that we have, is that at 15, the children who were in the academic programs were more likely to be involved in delinquent activity than children who were in the less academic programs, the more child-centered programs. I think the most powerful data comes from schools. One of the most consistent findings we have in the public school system is the children who are the youngest in the kindergarten class, and that's true whether they're 4 and the oldest are 5, or youngest are 5 and the oldest are 6, do more poorly both short and long term than children who are the oldest. That is, these children are more likely to drop out of school, more likely to have poor grades than our children who are the oldest. Now, that has nothing to do with intelligence. It has to do with the fact that the curriculum is always geared to the oldest children, which means that if you have a curriculum which is too hard, you're teaching reading the kindergarten to first grade before these children are ready, that they're going to have learning problems. So that what you see here is the direct effect of a curriculum which is not appropriate for that age group. And I think you can extend that backwards if you're pushing these kids. If you have that effect already at kindergarten, you're certainly going to have it at an earlier age as well. That if these children are exposed to things which they can't learn, the feeling of failure and so on, although it's not the same in school as in school because they may, not the social kind of thing, but if these children are if parents are doing it at home, but if they're learning it in a school situation and they fail at an early age, the possibilities are just the same as they will be later, that those children are going to have more difficulty later than earlier. All the evidence suggests that earlier is not better as far as education is concerned. Of course, you don't wait forever, but what we do is age appropriate. We give the kind of children the kind of learning experiences and the kind of instruction that is most appropriate for that age level. The problem with these early instructional programs is that they're inappropriate to what we know about how children learn.
Dr. Eckin, let me ask you a couple of quick things before we run out of time. You are, in your practice, I believe, in your private practice, seeing a lot of young children who have symptoms of stress. Do you associate that with this super kids orientation?
Oh, yes. And I think that pediatricians are seeing that around the country. We see eating disorders, sleep disorders, belly aches and headaches are what we're seeing. I have a pediatrician friend who's treating a four-year-old for a peptic ulcer. Stress is an extraordinary demand for adaptation. When we expect children to do things which they're not prepared to do, when we expect them to deal with and learn things which are too difficult for them to learn, that's an enormous stress. And so I think miseducation does stress children, and we're seeing the impact of this on obviously there are many other stresses in children's lives, but when we couple those with academic pressures far beyond what the child can cope with, then we maximize that stress. And so I think you're very right. We are seeing more stress in young children today than in the past.
You point out that a lot of parents assume that their children really like the ballet lessons that they're being sent to at 3 years old, or really like learning how to read when they're two because they seem to enjoy it. But you say that it's sometimes hard to tell whether they're enjoying the pleasure it's bringing the parents, or whether they're actually enjoying the lessons themselves. How would you recommend that parents evaluate whether their children are actually enjoying and appreciating, benefiting from the extracurricular type things that the parents are trying to give them at a very early age?
Well, if the child does it without their being present, if they continue to take Suzuki or take ballet if the parents aren't there, then it's clear that the child does it. Often the parents are there and urging and the child on. It's very difficult once the child's begun, because the child knows that that's something the parent wants them to do, and therefore children will, often do it to please the parents, rather than because it's something that they themselves want to do. Whereas the studies of gifted and talented people who really been successful in life suggest that those parents watch the child. And it seems to me very few children are going to want to do ballet by themselves at three. They may want to tap on the piano, they may want to tap. So it's hard for me to believe that that comes from the child. And then what you've done is you've imposed your priorities, which may sometimes work, on the child, rather than giving a child a sense to say what their vein is, where they want to go, the sort of things that make the most sense for them. And I think the evidence suggests that the best way to do it is for young children is to observe them and see where their interests lie, where their talents are, rather than trying to decide for them what we would like them to do.
Briefly, what would you suggest that parents look for in a nursery school or a daycare center?
Well, certainly would look for a teacher or teachers who have some training in early childhood development. Look for a program which is rich in materials such as blocks, which is organized into interest areas rather than desks, which has a place for language with books and places for children to read, cushions, perhaps a rocking chair, a good science and math area with but a lot of manipulative things for children to count and to measure, to water to and sand, to explore with, magnifying glasses, things like that. Children really need to manipulate the world. They learn a great deal, but they need to have very concrete things to learn with. A dramatic art area, a dramatic play area, with a lot of abandoned adult clothing, so like hat and shirts and shoes, that children can play with, tables for just doing a variety of different kinds of things, like making collages or making Easter baskets, all the different kinds of things that children do.
Sounds more like the conventional nursery school.
Yeah, conventional nursery school, but with using the materials, I think that we've progressed a lot. It may look the same, but what teachers do with those materials are very different, because they're exploring, they're expanding, they're helping those children learn a great deal more with a lot of the materials that are there. So it looks like, for example, children are just making soup, but they're learning a lot of things about it. They're learning to weigh and measure. They're learning the chemistry about what happens when you heat things. They're learning language. So I think teachers are more aware now of the kind of learning events that are happening in those activities, and are helping children to realize to the full the knowledge that can be acquired in those activities.
Well, David Elkin, I want to thank you very much for talking with us today. Thank you for being with
us.
Well,
thank you.
My guest has been Dr. David Elkin. He's a professor of child study at Tufts University and the president of the National Association for the Education of Young Children. He's the author of several books on child development. His new book is titled Miseducation: Preschoolers at Risk. It's published by Knopf. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On the next Fresh Air, I'll speak with Chuck Norris, the macho martial arts movie star who co-wrote and stars in the new film Braddock: Missing in Action, Part 3. I hope you can join us. Thank you.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, bringing the sounds of Broadway to the audience, I speak with sound designer Martin Levan, who worked on Andrew Lloyd Webber's musicals Starlight Express, Song and Dance, and Phantom of the Opera, which is about to open on Broadway. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new album from pianist Wayne Horvitz, cornetist Butch Morris, and drummer Bobby Previtt. It's called Nine Below Zero, and Kevin says it's one of the few jazz albums to use synthesizers and retain a sense of humanity. And television critic David Bianculli previews a retrospective about television called Television, which premieres on public television this week. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Mara Liasson in Washington. Secretary of State George Shultz today assured the Senate that the NATO alliance will be strengthened by the intermediate-range missile treaty with the Soviet Union. Shultz was the administration's first witness at the start of ratification hearings by the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Shultz admitted the Soviet Union has something to gain by the treaty, but he suggested that Soviet acceptance is not cause for U.S. rejection.
This is not a one-sided agreement. It clearly benefits us, but Mr. Gorbachev would not have signed it if he did not feel that it served his interest to do so. Arms control treaties must, by their very nature, be of mutual benefit.
Shultz was handed a top-secret document by Republican Senator Jesse Helms, which Helms says casts doubt on Soviet compliance with the treaty. Shultz refused to comment on the document. Helms, who opposes the INF Accord, did not disclose details of the report. White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said today there is nothing new in a letter President Reagan received Saturday from Nicaraguan President Daniel Ortega. The letter reportedly asks for an end to U.S. aid to the Contras. In return, Ortega promises to surrender power if defeated in a national election. He also said he would reduce the size of the Nicaraguan army and expel Soviet and Cuban military advisors. President Reagan is expected to call for a delay of lethal supplies to the Contras when he submits his aid request to Congress. White House officials say the president has decided to withhold delivery of arms to see whether the Sandinista government abides by the Central American peace agreement. Mr. Reagan is expected to outline details of the rebel aid request during his State of the Union address, scheduled for 9 o'clock tonight, Eastern Time. In Arizona today, officials certified that they have received enough petition signatures to force Governor Evan Mecham to stand in a recall election. According to State Elections Director Jim Shumway, the governor will be notified about the petitions by letter tomorrow.
The delivery of the letter to the governor is the next, I guess, important step that will happen. And then the governor has a period of 5 days to respond relative to the situation if he wishes to resign. Or he has 10 days in which to submit his defense of his official conduct in office.
Mecham has repeatedly said he has no plans to resign. The South American country of Suriname returned to democracy today as Ramsawak Shankar was inaugurated as president. Shankar was unanimously chosen last week by the National Assembly to serve a 5-year term. His inauguration ended 8 years of military rule. In Colombia today, the attorney general was kidnapped by gunmen. Two of his bodyguards were killed, the BBC's Peter Nares reports.
The kidnapping of the Colombian attorney general occurred in the early morning as Mr. Maro was driving to Medellin Airport. The occupants of two jeeps are reported to have opened fire on Mr. Maro's vehicle, and the attorney general's bodyguard and driver were shot dead. Mr. Maro was seized by the gunman who drove off with him. Police later found at the scene of the attack Mr. Maurer's blood-stained jacket. A major security operation has been launched in a bid to rescue Mr. Maurer. But it is still not clear whether the Attorney General has been kidnapped by far-left guerrillas or criminals, possibly cocaine smugglers.
Peter Nares in Bogota, Colombia. A group of Soviet scientists today began a tour of the American nuclear test site in the Nevada desert. It's part of a superpower agreement aimed at resolving differences over verification of treaties on limiting nuclear tests. The scientists will review the layout and equipment at the range, which has been the nation's nuclear proving ground for 37 years. A strong advance on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose nearly 43 points to close at 1946.45. Advances led declines 3-2 in very heavy trading of 275 million shares. In Washington, I'm Mara Liasson.
This is Fresh Air. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review of a new collaboration between pianist Wayne Horvitz, cornetist Butch Morris, and drummer Bobby Previtt. All three are New York-based improvisers and composers with distinctive styles, but they've got something in common. Their work isn't always characterized as jazz, but they are mindful of jazz rhythms. Their new album, Nine Below Zero, features an unusual mix of acoustic and synthesized sounds.
Whether jazz musicians should or shouldn't use high-tech equipment is really a bogus issue. What are the piano and saxophone if not technological triumphs? Even the debate over electronics was effectively settled 50 years ago. Fats Waller played electric organ on a 1938 recording date, and Floyd Smith played wailing steel guitar power chords with Andy Kirk's band 6 months later. Once the electric guitar and organ were established, it appeared to be a short step to synthesizers and from synthesizers to drum machines. That last step was really the most drastic. A rhythm box, with its strict regularity of pulse and dynamics and attack, seems antithetical to jazz, which prizes timbral nuance and an elastic beat. Drum machines, after all, fueled the monotonous thump of disco. But none of these pitfalls will stop improvisers from checking out new hardware. One of the more successful attempts at humanizing the machinery comes from the trio of pianist Wayne Horvitz, cornetist Butch Morris, and drummer and percussionist Bobby Previtt. Their album, Nine Below Zero, is on the Sound Aspects label. The trio's loose romps on Horvitz's compositions were recorded live in the studio, with no edits or overdubs. Without a formal rhythm section, and with the players doubling on several instruments, the music may recall the open-ended small groups of the late 60s Chicago avant-garde. But there are also traces of Brian Eno's ambient music and impressionistic European jazz. More important, Horvitz, Morris, and Previtt blend in synthesizers and electronic percussion as well. That's the opening of Wayne Horvitz's Nine Below Zero. One thing that keeps this music from sounding sterile is Butch Morris's crudely expressive cornet,
which harks back a century to the blaring brass bands that evolved into the first jazz ensembles. Another reason the music works so well is that the players effectively blur the lines between acoustic and electric instruments. Marimba may get tangled up with synthesizer, raspy synthesizer with ragged cornet, live percussion with sequencer rhythm. You're tempted to keep a scorecard to figure out who plays what, where, on which instruments. But that's kind of like going to see an action movie to check where the stunt doubles fill in for the stars. If it moves right, you won't care. Listen to the quick change work on Three Places in Southern California. Wayne Horvitz, Butch Morris, and Bobby Previtz structure these loose performances as they go along, seemingly unaware of where they'll wind up. That approach ensures the music's organic feel, even if a power outage would bring the proceedings to a halt.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat Cadence and Jazz Times magazines. He reviewed the new recording Nine Below Zero, which is on the Sound Aspects label. Listening to Fresh Air. Tuesday night on Broadway, when Phantom of the Opera opens, Martin Levan hopes everything will sound perfect. He wants the music to fill the theater, surround the audience, and sound natural without anyone noticing the state-of-the-art amplification system that he's put in place. Levan is a sound designer who has collaborated with Andrew Lloyd Webber on the musicals Cats, Starlight Express, and now Phantom of the Opera. Levan also engineered the cast recording of Phantom. Theatergoers frequently complain about how false amplification sounds in theaters and how muddy actors and singers sound through the speaker system. I asked Levan what the problem is.
I think a lot of the problems start just with the essence of what we're trying to do with amplification. If one considers what you're doing, you have a microphone and a loudspeaker with a lot of things in between. If you push sound through a loudspeaker, it's never going to be near where the performer is. So inevitably, the sound comes from another place. And that's the first thing that tends to go wrong in a theatre. People are watching performers on a stage, and they hear the sound coming from the side of the stage or from a wall, from where a speaker's mounted, not from the person singing.
I think another problem is that, you know, here you are, it's not a movie, it's an actual real live performance.
That's right.
And yeah. You're hearing actors and they sound like they're coming through a bad record instead of being there live.
That's right. Sound as a medium is a fairly new thing, not only in theatre, obviously, even in studios. And in essence, it's still very primitive. We still use microphones. In a studio, you're able to position those microphones very carefully near someone's mouth when they're singing or near a musical instrument. In the theatre, you're not usually able to do that.
Because the actors are moving around.
The actors are moving around. You can't suddenly position great, huge-looking microphones in the middle of the stage and ask them to stand by them and sing. You have to pick them up as they're moving, as they're puffing and panting and jumping about.
One thing that's hard to figure is how come there's so much amplification now, and for so many years, the theater used to get by without it? What's changed? Have singing styles changed, or performance styles, that there's now such a reliance on amplification?
Well, that's a very interesting topic, actually. There's probably a lot of reasons that amplification has become more and more used. What I think happens is that as soon as you invent a way of giving a director or some creator of a show some new assistance to his art, in other words, if I can explain, maybe someone can sing looking upstage instead of looking at the audience, as soon as you give them that opportunity, then they will start to develop more and more ideas of moving the people around on the stage. And they start. The more you start to depend on technology, the more and more you do of that. And in the end, you end up really having to work very hard to just achieve something that could have been done many years ago by lining them up on the front of the stage, sound-wise.
So what is the job of the sound designer? What are you called in to do?
Okay, well, I think it can really be broken down into probably two main areas. First of all, the originator and the director of a show has a concept for that show. And the sound designer, in one part, has to provide the medium to allow the director's work to, you know, be shown to the audience. The other side of the sound designer's work is actually a creative side, is part of creating an acoustic environment for people to listen to the show in. And it's not purely a case of getting the lyrics across to the audience. Sound being quite an invisible medium sometimes can be very, very powerful. And you can do certain tricks with sound that the audience aren't aware of, they don't notice happening, but does affect their enjoyment tremendously of the show.
Is there an example of a trick like that that you could give?
Well, it's very, very difficult to pick up a simple example. Certainly, to be very, very basic, certain volumes of sound, certain echoes of sound, can dramatically change the mood of the listener.
Now, you've already worked on the British production of Phantom of the Opera. The Broadway production is about to open. What were some of the special challenges that Phantom of the Opera presented to you?
Okay, Phantom of the Opera is probably one of the hardest type of shows for a sound designer to work on. The amplification on the show needs to be very natural sounding. We had a very small theatre in London where we did the show, which was not, it was quite tricky, but not too hard to achieve that sort of result. When we came to Broadway, we're in a much, much bigger house here. So to fill the house with sound, we needed to provide rather more amplification. And of course, as soon as you start to try and do that, you can start to take away from the concept of the natural sound, you know, hearing the performer and the sound coming from the performer. But we actually stuck with the same basic system as we used in London, and it worked very well here for us.
Could you describe what that system is? I guess in terms that those of us who aren't engineers would understand.
Probably the best way to describe it is that it's a system of hundreds of components. There's thousands of speakers all over the theatre, all doing very small functions. So rather than having a left channel and a right channel of a stereo speaker system, you have a lot of speakers, each with a small job to do. But the combined effect is a very large system.
Well, let me ask you this. You said earlier that one of the problems that you face in a theatre is that you don't want people's voices to sound as if they're coming from speakers on the side wall.
That's right.
As opposed to coming out of the actors who are performing. So if you have hundreds of little speakers or thousands all over the theater, how do you get around that? How do you make it so that it doesn't sound like it's coming from these speakers?
Okay. One thing we do by using lots of speakers, it stops us, you know, using any one speaker very loud. So that actually gives us a good starting point. Another way we achieve this is by using delay techniques. And this is a system whereby the sound from the performer is picked up by a microphone and is processed through the sound desk and through the amplifiers. And in the processing, the sound is delayed so that as the sound from the stage would naturally reach the member of the audience, the sound coming from the speaker is synchronized so that it also reaches the audience at the same time, and the attention isn't drawn to it that way. If you do not delay the sound, then the sound comes from the speaker early to the audience because the speaker inevitably is nearer the audience.
Are you using those wireless microphones?
We're using quite a lot of wireless microphones, yes. We use about 20 wireless microphones on Phantom.
How do they work? You know, you're used to seeing wires coming out of them, and now there's wireless ones.
Now there's wireless, yes. Well, they're very clever things. They work in the same way as your broadcasts reach your audience around the country. It's a very, very tiny transmitter, about the size, a little smaller than a cigarette packet. The performer wears that somewhere on their body, usually on their back or in their pocket or something. And we have a very, very tiny microphone that plugs into that, and that's wired into the transmitter. And we transmit, and we receive.
Now, since you're operating with receivers, do you ever accidentally pick up radio station signals?
Well, yes, that can happen as well. I mean, we get better and better at that over the years. When radio mics were first used, taxi cabs, all sorts of other signals used to interfere.
Has that ever happened to you in the middle of a real production?
Well, yes, there's one story from London, which was a rather unfortunate story. When we opened Starlight Express, there was an outside broadcast van from a certain radio station that was in the vicinity that just happened to blot out half of our radio mics, and we had a bit of a nightmare performance that night. And it can still happen. Frequencies, the allocation of radio mic frequencies, which is the critical area, is still really being developed, as it's quite a new art, quite a new thing for the theatre to use so many radio frequencies. And until specific frequencies are allocated, there's always a chance of, you know, bumping into someone that's sharing your frequencies. And it's not nice when it happens, but touch wood, it hasn't happened yet to Phantom over here.
Phantom of the Opera has been in previews. The curtain is about to go up for opening night. What will you be doing on opening night?
I won't be sitting in the audience. I'll be standing at the back. I'll probably be pacing up and down, praying that the technical stuff holds together. I'll obviously be, hoping the audience has a great time. I just hope for a smooth, clean show.
Well, Martin, I wish you good luck on opening night.
All right, thank you very much.
Martin Levan is the sound designer for the new Broadway musical, Phantom of the Opera. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Let's check in with Robert Siegel, who hosts the program. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
Well, tonight's the president's last State of the Union address.
That's right. And this morning, hearings began in the Senate on what may be one of the biggest issues if this is last year in office, that is the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty. We'll have a report on the testimony from Secretary of State Shultz and Secretary of Defense Carlucci. Also, we'll have a report on what Congressman Jack Kemp, one of the president's would-be successors, says when he's out campaigning, a brief version of his stump speech. Also, a report about a drug kidnapping in the South American country of Colombia, drug wars in Oakland, California, and jury tampering in Brooklyn.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Television becomes a museum of itself on a new 8-part series, which premieres this week on PBS. The series is called Television. It was adapted for American TV from a British documentary series. Our TV critic David Bianculli has this review.
The documentary series called Television is 8 hours long, but it only takes a few minutes to learn what's wrong with its approach. Here's how host Edwin Newman introduces the first episode.
It is not our intention to cover television as a business story, to explore the arcane ins and outs of network politics or behind-the-scenes backstabbing of the Hollywood studios.
That's too bad, because any serious show about TV ought to talk about that a lot. What we see on the tube is very important, but so is why we see what we see. This series called Television, though, has another mission.
We will explore television in the way that we as the audience know it best, through the pictures we see, the programs we watch. In the process, we hope to do what the best of television does, inform and entertain.
There's no question that it entertains. No show with this many TV clips and unforgettable images could flop as entertainment. But informing, that's where the series Television really drops the ball. And that's a shame, because it's taken this long for TV in general, and PBS in particular, to take the medium of television seriously enough to do a major series about it. So when the chance finally comes up, what does PBS do? It treats TV trivially and condescendingly. Instead of offering analysis, it offers home movies. And when it does interview the creative people behind some of TV's best news and entertainment shows, it doesn't give them much time to speak. In this example, the first voice you'll hear is that of veteran news producer Fred Friendly, followed by MASH creator Larry Gelbart.
The problem with television in this country is that commercial television makes so much money doing its worst that it can't afford to do its best.
With most television, the only way you get a feeling out of it is if you touch it while you're wet.
Those aren't interviews. They're sound bites, the kind of snappy one-liners that make the evening news and Entertainment Tonight. As a matter of fact, this television series is very much like an expanded version of Entertainment Tonight, which ought to explain why I'm so disappointed by it. There are moments where the show works. In its episode on drama, it goes straight from the BBC's The Singing Detective to an American Playhouse production of True West, thereby comparing the best of British and American drama. Unfortunately, moments like that are few and far between. It would have been nice to compare American sitcoms to the British shows that inspired them, to see the original British versions of All in the Family and Three's Company, but this series doesn't bother. Most of the time, it just chooses the wrong clips. Someone must have worked hard to find the only unfunny scenes from Taxi and the Mary Tyler Moore Show, and it throws them together without any persuasive or incisive commentary. It's worth watching, though, as a brief guided tour of TV, and for a few of the surprise stops it makes along the way. I like the segment on foreign game shows, and also enjoyed this segment from What's My Line. The panelists are blindfolded while trying to guess the identity of their visitor, but since this is radio, you can play along with your eyes open.
Sooner or later, every Hollywood star appeared on America's What's My Line as a mystery guest, complete with a disguised voice.
Yes. Judging from the applause, I take it that you are a performer. Have you done serious dramatic parts in pictures?
Oh, yeah.
Give up? That was the former host of Death Valley Days and the current resident of the White House, Ronald Reagan. Honest.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Tomorrow, I'll speak with juggler Penn Jillette. As half of the comedy and magic team of Penn and Teller, he's performed on Saturday Night Live, Late Night with David Letterman, and on Broadway. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward will profile Hank Ballard and the Midnighters, best known for their sexually suggestive songs in the 50s like Work With Me, Annie. And book critic John Leonard will review Woodcutters, the novel by the Austrian writer Thomas Bernhard. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Lisa Bruton and Ed Doherty. Research assistants from Ruth Harold, Kathy Anderson, Anita McGlynn, and Sue Spolin. Our engineer is Audrey Voblaitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.